Everybody who called in, I thank my guest from the ACLU, Catherine McDowell, and stay tuned for more great programming here on KBO Community Radio. And thank you, Sonia, for board hopping. Bye, everybody.
From the Wings Archive, in honor of Pride Vancouver. Short stories by the late Jackie Crossland and the living Nora Randall, from 1996.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The Wedding by Jackie Crossland.
It wouldn't be a surprise to anyone who knew the two of us to learn that the actual invitation was addressed to Catherine and not to me. Catherine is the social one. She knows more people than most people get to meet in their entire lifetime if they don't work in busy department stores or airports. Anyway, this invitation came in the mail. Catherine saying with this note of surprise as she opens the only letter not addressed to occupant, "We've been invited out." "Oh yeah," I says, in my taciturn way. "Hey, I guess you notice me as a person of few words. All us Haggertys are taciturn. It's what you'd call a family trait. This nervous chatter is just the family cover-up for a deep urge towards zen-like silence." "We've been invited to a wedding," she says.
"A what?"
"A wedding. Well, of sorts, anyway. This is an invitation to Jane and Cleo's for a ceremony of commitment. Look, printed invitation and everything." Now, I don't know Jane and Cleo very well, although I have met them through Catherine. And they seem like nice enough women.
"Why are they doing that?" I asked.
"I don't know," she says. "I guess they just want to do something. They've been together for years."
People are so strange. That's all I can think of to say. That's all I can think of to think. But whatever I could think of to say, or to think, or not to think, I wouldn't have missed this one for the world.
So dawns the day of the ceremony of commitment of Cleo and Jane. I will shower, I will bathe, I will wear white pants and maybe Catherine's new shirt and, of course, my dark glasses. Well, in between the arrival of the invitation and the actual event itself, I had a lot of time to consider the whole subject of weddings. And I think, what do weddings have to do with me? Now, I have always believed that the greater purpose of marriage
was to assist with the transfer and dispersal of real property from one owner to another. And so, I have always agreed that gay men and lesbians should be allowed to get married because everybody should get to dance the property shuffle if that's what they want to do. On the other hand, I also sincerely believe that property is theft. And so you see how stupefied I could become just considering the matter of marriage and the inherent contradictions. Well, okay, I say. Maybe marriage to a woman, say, for example, Catherine, would be different. But how? I love Catherine. I really like living with her. But what would marriage change about that? In the matter of property, I could just write a will, giving Catherine first dibs on my non-existent valuables. If it comes to that, we could buy property together if we had the money, which we don't, but that's another problem. Okay, maybe a ceremony of commitment is different from a wedding in the traditional sense. You want to tell your community who you love, claim a spot for it. It's okay with me. I can live with that. I'll even iron the shirt. So, we're in the bathroom on the morning of the big day, primping and preening. Who says dykes don't primp and preen? When I didn't want to wear dresses, my mother would say, "Oh dear, I just despair. You don't seem to care what you look like." And I would think, "Okay, I guess I just don't care what I look like." But both mother and I were wrong. I do care. I work at it day and night, tirelessly tending the garden of myself, what I want to look like is this. And Catherine says, "You look good." "Uh-huh. Just as I planned." And then I turn to Catherine and I say, "Catherine, when we've been together, oh, I don't know, 10, 12 years, however long it's been for them, do you think we might want to do a little ceremony of some sort?" And she says, "I hope not." "Why not?" "Well," she says thoughtfully, "the last one of these things I went to, the women were celebrating, I don't know, their umpteenth anniversary, and 2 weeks later they broke up. It was awful. People were devastated." "Ah," I say, and I worried. But I pull myself together and we're off to that party. We buy a plant as a gift on the way to Jane and Cleo's, and it was a perfect day. The street where they live is lined with blossoming cherry trees, and on this particular day, the trees were just beginning to let their petals fall in the early summer breeze, so that the sidewalk to their house was a flower-strewn path, like in the Hollywood movie musicals of the 40s, and me in my crisp whites, and Catherine in her fluorescent orange. What a sight! Of course, all this perfection was a trifle marred at first. We passed another woman on her way to the ceremony, carrying a big package, silver and white bow, and, check it out, a cellular phone. And she stood there, red-faced and furious, shrieking into this instrument, "I'm really not happy at all with this service. I have not been able to reach my own home number for 3 days to get my messages, and I want something done about it. Not now, but right now. Is that clear?" Well,
The little petals flattened themselves against the sidewalk. At least one robin stopped mid-song. And this scene made me worry. What if this woman, ranting on the phone, is an omen? What if Jane and Cleo stand up among the cherry blossoms and the friends to scream, "We're really not happy, not happy at all"? But I pull myself together, and we go into the house. So now we're at the party. In spite of my smart mouth, I'm really a very nervous person when faced with people in groups. But I have devised, for the shy among you, a basic party strategy which works pretty well most of the time. I get a glass, I pour some designer water in it, and I look around for an empty, comfortable chair. If there isn't one, I make eye contact with someone who is seated in one and limp slowly toward them. When the person rises, I ease myself down. Now, selectively use this technique will not fail you, but you shouldn't use it too often with people that know you well. Basically, the idea is to sit in one spot. Once seated, somebody talks to you, talk back like a normal person. Nobody talks to you, savor the water. Listen to the music. Look content. That's really important. You look depressed, and terrible things could happen. Someone might try to help you by offering therapeutic type advice, or worse, you might be ignored altogether because you just look like bad news. You might never get invited anywhere again. Well, I'm lucky with this technique because Catherine likes to roam at parties. She watches where I claim my spot. She goes off to do raging party chat. She comes back. We go home. She used to think I was antisocial. She'd say, "Did you talk to anybody or just sit there like a bump on a log?" And I would wilt. But now, with my new party strategy, I can reply with confidence. As a matter of fact, I talked to several people, and two of them told me the most interesting things about the history of mineral ore seams in northern Manitoba. And then she says, "Oh, well, I'm as ready for this party as I'm likely to get. Got my glass with ginger ale to look especially festive. Got my chair, though that wasn't easy because the party is mostly in the backyard. But I manage, and I sit back and I bide my time. I know a few people at the party. They drop by to say hello. And pretty soon I find out that this is a big family occasion. People have come from all over Hell's Half Acre for this one. Well, I'm immediately jealous, because I can't imagine the Haggertys looking this cheery about Catherine and me, much as they like Catherine. Hey, what do you think? Mr. and Mrs. P. Haggerty, request the honor of your presence at the Chippewa County Golf and Country Club for the ceremony of commitment of their daughter, Maureen Mary Haggerty, and Catherine Elizabeth Hunt." I don't think so. But I could ask. Well, in due course, somebody comes up and says, "I think they're going to start now." Well, now I'm really worried. I spill my ginger ale. "Where's Catherine? Where's Catherine? I can't see her anywhere. Oh, I should have said I had the flu." And then it starts. Now, two musicians, drummers, have been hired up for the occasion, and they start drumming and moving across the lawn. People clear a path, then somebody steps on my glass. Oh, what do? I pick up the pieces. I don't know what to do with them. I put them in my lap, like some kind of a house pet. I feel completely weird, and I don't know why. And then, this is what happened. The drummers were followed by Cleo and Jane, all dressed up in nice clothes and whatnot, and they all move across the lawn and come to rest under a canopy kind of thing that's been rigged up. And there's neighborhood kids hanging out over the fence. Now, the ceremony consisted of some pieces of music, which some people played, and some pieces of poetry, which other people read. And then Jane and Cleo made a kind of declaration to each other. And then they exchanged rings. And then they thanked us all for coming and said we should eat and drink and have a good time. And there'd be music later for dancing. And so the party continued. And that was that. No disaster. Wow. My eyes watered. My nose ran. Could have been allergies. I don't have allergies. Well, I took off my dark glasses, blew my nose, wiped my eyes, looked around. People are kind of shuffling around. Some are laughing, some are crying some. A little girl fell and scraped her knee, had to be comforted. Well, Catherine comes over to me and she says, "Are you all right?" "Well, yeah," I says. "But I got this glass in my lap." Well, so she helps me wrap it up in a napkin. We throw it in the trash. She gets me some more ginger ale. And when she turns to move away, I break my party rule and follow her around for a while. Now we listen to Jane tell the story of how she and Cleo picked their rings. And I wait till she's finished, and then I say, "How'd you know what to say in the ceremony?" And she says, "We didn't." It got very interesting. There's no ceremony written for us. We had to make it up from scratch. And after a while, that kind of made sense, because that's how we've led our lives. We've just made it up as we go along. "Well, all the best to you," I says. Catherine kind of laughed. Well, a few weeks later, Catherine's out in the garden, talking to the garlic plants. And I'm in the living room, reading the newspaper. And I read where, in Denmark, their parliament has given overwhelming approval to legislation permitting gay marriages. And I go out in the back and I tell Catherine, and she says, "Hey, that's great. You want to move to Denmark?" No, I don't think so," I said. But could we plant a tree in the backyard here and kind of watch it grow? You know what I mean? I mean, even if we move out or split up or whatever, we could come back and take a look at it. Unless, of course, they bulldoze the place and put up condominiums. But you know what I mean? Could we do that? And she says, "Sure." So you know what we did? We planted a monkey puzzle tree, and it's there still.
Forget-Me-Nots by Nora D. Randall.
Beth doesn't actually remember where she first met me. I think it was at Myra's 40th birthday party. And Beth thinks that's entirely possible. But Myra says that Beth couldn't come to her 40th birthday party because she had to work. And Myra remembers that because she was disappointed, and Beth thinks that's also entirely possible. I think it's like life on laughing gas. When Beth and I first started going out together, she was working a full-time job in trying to start her own business. So she'd go to work at her job from 7:30 in the morning to 3:30 in the afternoon. Then she'd go to her own office and work till 7 or 8 in the evening. So I kind of took to dropping by at night and saying, oh, well, I was just downtown shopping. I wondered if you wanted a ride home, and she always did. She says that except for me, she remembers that time like walking across the bottom of a swimming pool. It was just nice to sit back, relax, be driven home. Well, then she noticed that no matter how totally exhausted she was, she always asked me in for tea. And she says, you know, if I didn't know better, I'd think something was going on here. Well, I told Beth, she's the person who taught me that it's possible to be smart and also slow. Well, of course, I grew up thinking smart and quick were the same thing, and I'd always been considered both by the people around me, and this allowed me to become very successful, and after a while I realized miserably unhappy. Well, happiness is overrated, I told myself. It's just another North American luxury. And then I realized I couldn't live without it. I couldn't get out of bed in the morning. I couldn't turn the television off in the afternoon. I couldn't get to sleep at night. My mind raced. I must do something. I must be happy. So I took a little time off work and I began to feel better. But then when I went back, I couldn't stand it. So I quit altogether. Well, I took temporary jobs, grant jobs, untraditional work for women. I didn't have nearly the money that I'd had before, and that was definitely a problem, but at least the jobs didn't last long, and I no longer felt obligated to make impossible situations work. I had fallen out of the managerial class, and I consider that the primary achievement of my 30s. And then I met Beth. I still think it was at Myra's 40th birthday party. I remember sitting in the lawn chair with my feet in the wading pool. I'd just come back from an all-day moving job. Well, Beth was seated at the picnic table, and she was staring at her feet. And I said, you look like you're deep in conversation with your toes. And she laughed, and she says, well, actually, I wish I were, but my ankles are screaming at me. So we exchanged sore feet stories. Well, I'd been on mine all day, and she had an old ski injury that was aggravated by heat. So I talked her into moving over and putting her feet in the pool. That turned out to be a good idea, because you see, there were three big blocks of ice in the pool because it was also being used to keep the drinks cold. Well, Beth introduced me to her friend Erica, who made beautiful, comfortable shoes, and we went together to get my foot measured and to pick the color and pick the style. Well, I was thrilled because all my life I've had trouble finding comfortable shoes because my feet are mostly described as awfully wide for a woman. That's good, says Beth. Keeps you off the straight and narrow. Heh heh heh. Well, we both had a sense of humor, which delighted us, but we didn't at all laugh at the same things, which we found interesting. Also, there was no telling what either of us would forget, or when. Don't you think we're a little young for this, says Beth one day, while I'm trying to get the coat hanger through the window of the car door. Well, we went shopping, you see, and I left the keys in the ignition, then locked all the car doors, and Beth forgot to pick up the duplicate set she got cut. Well, at least I remembered to get them cut, she says. Well, I'm still trying to reach the little lock knob. You're right, I said. We are too young. This is some dreaded brain disease. This isn't aging. It's pre-death. Heh, heh, heh. Well, Beth doesn't always appreciate my different sense of humor. When we first started sleeping together, which was when we first started living together, there was this period of adjustment. The two things had happened at the same time, because Beth said that she was far too busy to add a lover to her life if it meant she had another place to go to. On the other hand, she did have to go home every night to eat and sleep, and if the lover were there, it just might work out. Well, I could see the sense in that. Also, I figured, well, if it's going to work at all, it'll work out now as well as later. Which turned out to be essentially true, though it didn't keep us from being surprised by ourselves or by each other. Well, after my determined pursuit of Beth, I became slow to rouse. Beth, after being totally oblivious for months, was hot to trot. Well, Beth feared that such a cliched beginning might mean that it would soon become boring. Well, no one ever in my entire life had ever suggested I might be boring. I was devastated. Well, Beth was bitterly disappointed, and she thought I deliberately misunderstood her, and I feared that my love was not enough for Beth, and she vowed to herself that she would not take care of me. And I noticed that retreat, and also the unmistakable odor of righteousness emanating from it. And that pissed me off. I sulked. A leaden cloud of tension settled over the house. Beth presented me with a t-shirt that said, "I'll never forget what's her name." "That's a cliche," I said. Beth was stung. She'd tried to make up, and I had thrown her fears in her face. She became seriously worried that we would fall apart, and she'd have to move out and get over it. And she didn't see how she could keep up her life if that happened. She said she remembered with a shock her contempt of women who stayed in marriages for convenience. She said she felt old and an unwanted sense of sisterhood. Beth bought a copy of the Boston Women's Health Collective's latest book, Our Bodies Growing Older. I called it Our Bodies, Damn It. She decided to quit her job and to concentrate on her business. She said she realized that the time in her life when she could work 14 hours a day was over. She realized that that was just a youthful excess, like drinking or sex. Well, then she had anxiety attacks about money. "Why worry about something you don't have?" I said. Well, she laughed. And she began to feel better. She decided that I was a very wise woman, like a witch, who understood the profound root of life and could heal from this knowledge. And she asked me to explain it to her. I had no idea what she was talking about. "I only said that to be funny," I said. Well, she laughed again. She said, "Maybe it is like life on laughing gas." One day, I came home from the grocery store, and she was sitting on the back steps. She forgot her house keys. Something in the way she sat there so still, with her hands in her lap, caused me to stop and look at her. I could not take my eyes off her face. Like a large, airy room, French doors thrown wide, the floor becoming the calm surface of a lake, reflecting the endless open doors that I was drawn through. I went and sat beside her, picked up her hand and squeezed it. She brushed the hair out of my eyes. I sought her eyes with my own and entered.
The preceding stories are from Great Explanations, four lesbian stories written and read by Jackie Crossland and Nora Randall, taped distributed by Women's Press in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Good morning, everybody. Good evening to those of you who are in parts of the world where it's night, good afternoon, and so on. You are tuned in to Culture in Motion, twice monthly show here on KBOO.FM, KBOO Community Radio, Portland, Oregon. Here we talk about the intersections between art, culture, politics, activism, music, and things related to those. And I'm your host, Mike Crenshaw. Our co-host, Ryan Danley, is with me. And tonight, today we have a very special guest, good friend of mine, artist, activist,
survivor.
Survivors, somebody.